Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I've had the honour at Mad World for the last 3 years of doing the final session. We physically did it in person with Vince Cable and then with Ed Balls over the last 2 years. Obviously, both politicians, obviously, both ballroom dancers. And that's my question probably to Will is, has he ever thought about politics or ballroom dancing? And I should imagine that's going to be a very quick no and a no, unless you've got a Strictly sign up we don't know about.
I've been asked, but it would be horrific.
Yeah,
it'd be horrific for everyone.
But then again, we are talking about Ed Balls, and he became a legend partly because of that. And Ed is just fabulous last year at this. So, Will, lovely to have you here. And part of my job is just to kind of get you to tell your experiences. I mean, everybody who's signing on to this knows you. For the last 30 years, you've been a great celebrity, a great sportsman. People have known your ups and downs, kind of the thrust into the limelight at a very young age. So as we go through, I'd like to sort of take almost from the beginning. So at age 22, you become England captain.
Yeah.
As England captain, you are thrust into being in charge of a group of peers, but those peers are very experienced. They're people you've looked up to and considerable, and some of them significantly older than you. And I think if most leaders will be watching this, have tended to go very linearly up organizations and maybe hit sort of senior leadership in their late 30s, 40s, or even 50s. 22 is very, very young, and it's very, very young to be thrown into any significant leadership role, but one with such a great spotlight. So talk to me a little bit about what that initial period was like.
Well, yeah, it's just quite bizarre because I've said it a number of times, but I was heading home when I found out. I was heading home to my parents for dinner because obviously I was 22, male, couldn't cook. You know, couldn't do many things actually. Anyway, got there, and my mum said, "Jeff Cook, who was the manager at the point, he rang for you." And there was an England game coming up in a few weeks. And if you heard that Jeff Cook had rung for you, that meant you were being dropped. So I was like, "Ah." Oh. And I remember sitting there at home in the kitchen for 20 minutes, sort of going over. We'd toured Australia, hadn't gone very well, and thinking, you know, I wasn't great, but I didn't think I was that bad. Eventually, I plucked up the courage to call him. And ultimately, he sort of, you know, he went through the bit, but he just said, "Well, I'm calling because I'd like you to captain England." So I laughed. I said, "Yeah, very good, Jeff." He was a Yorkshireman, so I didn't know him for his humour. You know, he's just very, very straight. And he said, "I'm being serious." And I must have gone quite pale because my brother was in the kitchen, you know, sort of saying to me, "What, you know, what's happened? Are you dropped?" You know, and I got a piece of paper, and said, "I'm captain." I held it to him while I was on the phone. I can't repeat what he said, but it was what most people said. So, you put the phone down and it's like, wow. I just said yes to captaining England. And I'd never, ever thought of being captain of England. I'd only played for 8 months. And even then, I only really got first cap because of injuries. So it's bizarre. And you have no concept at that time. And I'm not sure I really had a concept of what it meant for quite a few years of media, of expectation, of the politics, of everything that, you know, really didn't interest me. And it was, for me, it was about rugby and that team, and that team were my heroes. So, you know, that was the bit that I found extraordinary, was everything that went with it that I wasn't interested in.
So let's take a step back to that. So most people, when they get a leadership job, it's about the job. And it's about the group that they're going to manage, et cetera, and take forward to a set of goals. So you have that with your team.
Yeah.
There are also people that are probably a bit surprised initially. They know that you're very talented, but suddenly like, wow, where did that come from? And I won't mention names, but some of your teammates were quite gobby. They were, you know, opinionated. They talked a lot. So you've got to manage them. Yeah. So let's talk about that bit. Then I'd like to talk about the bigger stakeholder management that you were thrown in, which is kind of an add-on to the job, but hugely important. So let's talk about that kind of induction into the the first day you kind of go back with them, how do you feel? How do you get yourself ready for that?
Well, I think I was petrified, to be honest. I remember the first time I stood up. But for me, the question was, once you put the phone down and everything settled down for the next few days, was just, why did you say yes? And I think it's a question I had four or five. Why do you want to lead? Why? What needs to be done? And I think lots of times, maybe it's in business or sport, people get promoted and they're going up the ladder, and I'm not sure they really ask themselves sometimes, why am I leading? You know, is this for me, or is this for my team? And for me, it was very easy. It was for the team. You know, this is England rugby. You have a privilege. And so therefore, very early on, you just understand that actually this is not about me. And this is certainly not about my ego or anything else. It's like, what do we need to do to start winning games? So my approach with them when I stood up, I think what really hit me when I stood back up as this young guy, you know, I looked in this room and thought, wow, there's all this talent, there's all this knowledge, you know, and I have neither. And what I need to do is, if I can tap into that, if I can get them to start telling me what we need to change, to get them to talk about, you know, how they see things, how can we improve things? It's like, then we stand a chance. And I think that for me was the key bit of, I just sat and listened. I used to go and speak to loads. The great bit for me was, I suddenly had a chance to go and speak to, like, most people that I wanted to. I went to speak. There's a guy, Mike Brearley, used to captain the, yeah. Went to speak to Mike, and gee, just blew my mind. I mean, what an incredibly impressive man. But so I went and picked the brains of anyone and everyone I could get hold of, from military, from sport, from business, and just sat and listened. And the same with the team. It's like, talk to me, you know, what do we need to do? What do we need to change? What ideas have you got? And you know, I basically became a sort of a funnel to pass them up to Jeff, because I was 22.
But it's interesting, that intuitive decision to go beyond just, I mean, not even just rugby and not even just going to cricket or other sports, but going to, as you said, the military and other areas. That's fascinating, because most leaders tend to stick in their bubble, and they tend to not kind of go, what can I learn from other sectors, other ideas, others? And that was actually, I think this, you can learn a lot about leadership, but there's also some people that do at 22 go, right, actually, I'm not going to just be bound by convention here. So I think that's fascinating. And I'm fascinating that you kind of, that was where you went to.
But I think you've got to be curious. You know, I'm back involved with England as the leadership mentor and talking to them. But even that, everything that you, everyone that you meet, there are bits that you're curious about. How did you do that? So what bits can I take away? And it might be one bit, or you might meet some fascinating people and think, wow, there's three or four bits there. But the whole time you're thinking, how? I love, you know, listening. It's like people who achieve. When I was there, I read every book there was on leadership. And books are great, you know, and academics. But I want to talk to people who have practically done things, because it's fascinating.
Right. So that's the team. And we'll come back to that again in a minute. But you had two groups of stakeholders. You had the management on the leadership of rugby as a whole. It was, let's say, stuck in a different time zone. You were challenging orthodoxy there. So you've got to deal with them. You've also got, actually, we also talk about external stakeholders in most businesses. But actually, the reality is you have the press. God knows how many hundreds of thousands of fans, all who believe they know everything about your sport better than you do. You have the other teammates, etc. So let's talk about the institution of rugby and you being a bit of an iconoclast and challenging the orthodoxy. How did that go? How did that feel at the time? And then let's also talk about you said it was a privilege to become England captain. Of course it was. And it was a great honour. But also the hopes and aspirations of way beyond just your team, is there's a whole country behind you looking at that. So I'd like to talk about that in a second. But first of all, the establishment. Talk to me about the establishment.
Well, the establishment must have thought, because I suppose, you know, I was, you know, university graduate, ex-army, sort of public school. They must have just thought this man's going to be perfect. And he ended up as an absolute nightmare. For me, because my frustration was, you know, my focus was on the team and winning and making England as successful as England can be. And I was frustrated that there were people who were running, who were involved in running rugby, who didn't have that same focus. And I found that incredibly disappointing. I can't go into obviously details because I'm sort of back. But it was and I had a frustration with that because, you know, I think without sounding glib, you wake up in the morning and it's rather like when we'll go on talk about the press or fans and everything else. But you look at yourself in the mirror and I tried very hard. Every morning you look at yourself in the mirror and you think, are you doing the right things? You'll be getting things wrong, but not on purpose. And I think that for me was with the committee, the people who ran rugby, again, I never wanted to curtail what I thought needed to be said, what needed to be challenged. For my extended stay as captain, it was like, if I lose my job because of this, so be it, because I believe this is what needs to be done. This is what needs to change to make England successful. And I wanted to be able to look myself in the morning and say, it doesn't matter whether you're not captain anymore, you've done the right thing. So I tried to live a little bit like that. And the same in a sense with the media. I think when we were chatting earlier, I told you the third game I had, I sat in front of the media and they've been pretty critical. And you're 22, you know, you have no PR people explaining to you anything. And so they sort of said, oh, well, you're a bit quiet today. And I said, well, yeah, actually, guys, I think some of your articles were very unfair about a certain number of the players. I don't think you understood what we were trying to do. And there was just silence. And this one guy sort of said, what are you doing? He said, well, I'm just giving you some feedback. He said, you don't criticise us. I said, so hang on, you can criticise, you can write an article that was written by millions of people, but I can't pass on my thoughts to you in private. And they sort of no. So I basically, you know, I told them to F off really. It's, you know, not great. And you'd sort of walk out. And I sat there. And I remember years later, Stuart Lancaster, who was one of the recent managers, I remember sitting with him and he was saying, well, I spend probably 60-70% of my time thinking about how to manage the media. And I think lots of people in business do, or as you say, fans. But actually, for me, what I thought, Mike, was the only thing that I can have an input into and really control is the team. And if we can get that working as well as I can, right? That's my job. That's the only thing I can control. And if we win, that's what we're about. That's our product. So therefore, don't worry about trying to be, the media. You can't control that. They will always have an angle. You learn very early on that's what they do. But and I think the same for business sometimes. You know, you create the best product, whatever it is. Focus on those bits. That's what you can change. That's what you can alter. Otherwise, you're always fighting against something that you really have no control over.
And that is that classic tension between strategy and tactics. And if you've got a clear strategy, assuming the strategy is right, you're able to kind of have a bit of a compass in the direction you're going. And then you're more likely not to be buffeted by the press, stakeholders, etc. Now, of course, that's assuming you're going in the right direction. So let's just take that, the kind of initial period. So there is that initial shock of you being thrust into, you know, a really wonderful role. It's kind of like your dream role, but you suddenly, I'm sure there were moments you went, really, wow, it's a bit early. But how did you balance you being an athlete? So there are lots of athletes who are solo, you know, runners, jumpers, etc., they focus on themselves and they are very much in their own bubble and are able to have incredible focus around their achievements. You're an athlete, but you're also a member of a team and you're the leader of the team. How do you balance Will Carling, the rugby player, with Will Carling, the team player? How did you kind of make sure that your game was still great? Because obviously as a leader, your game's got to be good as well.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the time I probably didn't get that balance correct. I think I ended up probably putting more energy and thought and focus on being the leader, trying to get the team ready, rather than me. I think if, you know, if I look back, if I had never captained England, I think I could have developed into a far more effective player. But I wouldn't have it any other way. But I think I tried in the build up to games to have my time of this is how me preparing mentally as a player. And then there was me preparing mentally as a captain. And you try to be fairly disciplined with yourself. But you used to get sucked into the, you know, all the players. You'd be trying to watch players, monitor players, you know, you'd see them at training, see them in meetings, you know, what frame of mind they're in, you go and talk to the medical staff, you know, has anyone been in? It's like, you know, is anyone down and up? They would sort of give me updates. So you're constantly trying to take the temperature of the team as you're building up to a game. And that tends to absorb you massively as a leader, I think, or it did for me. So I tried to get my personal preparation done almost like before, we came together as a team.
And how? Because sports teams are very intimate in a way, in terms of you're all there together, you're a huge amount of focus with thousands of fans watching you on it, and your mates as well. You know, there's a camaraderie that maybe doesn't apply always to businesses or to other organisations. How do you also, though, make sure you have the critical distance to be able to, on one hand, be mates with somebody, but at the same time, ultimately, you are the boss and you've got to kind of go, well, that didn't go terribly well. What are we going to do to change things?
I think people do think that, you know, all sports teams have this camaraderie, and they don't unless they work very hard at it. And we had to. I mean, when I was first got involved in England, geez, it was awful. You know, in the factions that were in there, the cliques and the lack of belief. People didn't talk about winning. It was just how many games could you play before you got dropped. People pretended that club rugby was more important to them than international rugby. So you had to work very hard at, you know, and I think it was the communication, honest communication. And very early on, I introduced upward appraisal. I got them all to appraise me because I thought, actually, you know, I've been put in this role of leader, but, you know, it was almost like, you know, I can't lead you at the moment. I haven't earned your trust. I haven't earned your respect. So talk to me about what you need from me. Talk to me about what I should change, what I'm not doing very well. And it was brutal. And it really was. And sometimes I listen to business people, you know, and I ask them, do you have an upward appraisal? We do, but it's anonymous. And I have to say, I look at them and think, what is the point of that? Because if you are not brave enough to accept, you know, to listen to your team, then why on earth should they ever listen to you? You know, you think you set the example. It's like, yeah, tell me and I will take this on board. And I think for me, once you start setting that tone of, yep, I'm, you know, I'm up for being criticized, I'm up to listening to the hard messages, then you think, okay, fine. Then you have at least a little bit of a stand to say, but actually, guys, we're not doing well enough here, do you think? You know, we need to improve this bit. And I think you certainly build up that honest communication. And honest communication, I think, is always really hard because we all want to do the nice bits. You know, it's like, well, you know, I want to sit next to it. But, and I think we're all the same. And you know, you've got to have two or three tricky conversations that day. And you keep putting them off. And eventually you go, oh, do you know what, I'll do it tomorrow. And it's those conversations that make the difference. And it's though, you know, making the effort for those uncomfortable conversations that make the difference within a team, because you've got to have those honest conversations. You've got to be, and people have got to be honest with each other. Certainly, you know, I think in any team, but certainly in sport, when you're going to go out and face what you face. So for me, that was crucial, but I think you set the tone as a leader.
So, winning and losing. So most organizations don't have necessarily the real crunch that sports teams have in terms of, you know, your sales might slip over a year, your numbers might fall in this things, or they might go off. But you literally have your, you know, Saturday afternoon moment of glory, and you've either won or lost 90 plus minutes later. Yeah. Talk to me about the psychology of winning, but also then let's talk about the bad side, you know, the days that it's just not gelling together. You have a bad match, you lose. you know, you led some amazing triumphs, and also you had some losses, like every human. So talk to me about the psychology of winning from your perspective. You took a team that wasn't doing particularly well and crafted them into a team that did well. So,
well, no, they crafted themselves into a team. You know, they, you know, and that's the truth, and that's not stupid humility. It just they did. You know, they were very talented, but I think we had to. Do you know what? I think a huge amount of what I spent time on was building confidence, and people sort of look at me and go, yeah, right, you know, rugby players confident, and you're like, no, rugby players are human beings, and they have the same fears and the same worries and the same concerns, and if you let them, they'll pretend, you know, because yes, mine was a male team, and we all know what, you know, most males are like, yeah, I'm fine, and yeah, good, and you're like, and you just have to look at him for a little bit of time and you think you're not good at all. So it was building people's confidence to actually go out, because I think we're all the same. I spent loads of times in teams where coaches, captains, you know, you just had to go out and they actually come out with a load of negative, no, for Christ's sake, don't miss any tackles and don't do this and don't do that. For God's sake, don't do this. And you run out like, oh, wow. You know, my view is as the pressure comes on, tell people how good they are, you know, remind them how good they are, little instances, because I play better when I'm confident. I think we all perform better in whatever it is that we do. When we're confident, we feel appreciated, we feel we know what our role is. And so, you know, a lot of it was, for me, was getting guys in I sat with Austin, who was one of our psychologists, and we changed the whole way we built up to games to make sure that, you know, we got all the negative reviewing and appraisals and, you know, an analysis out the way. And then as we got close to the game, it was about confidence. So that guys walked out there and they believed that, you know, we're good. We know what we're doing and we're good. And I trust him and I believe in him. And, you know, and a lot of the time it worked, but obviously there are times that it didn't. And that's, you know, those times are pretty hard. But those times, and again, it's how you analyze those and how you honestly talk about them, and I think that, you know, again is a mark of a team, and we got much better at it. There were some of us who still struggled with it, who could never admit that we, you know, we got things wrong or we were beaten in certain areas, but you know, it's there, it's on a tape, you watch it, you can see the footage, and that's the difference in sport, I suppose. You can, you know, there's not many times in business that you can just replay it and go, no guys, This is we got this wrong. Ooh, I've got a nosebleed. Sorry about that.
Right.
Where did that come from? You know, but it's like, you think it's amazing that, you know, you can't do that, but we could. And so you just think, so let's talk about it, not to blame, but actually let's learn, you know, what did we just get wrong there? What did we get wrong in the build-up? You know, were we conceited? Were we arrogant? Didn't we underestimate them? Because we went, I mean, God, going back in history here, we underestimated the Scots. We played them in 1990 up at Murrayfield, and they beat us convincingly. People say we lost the match and we got beaten. And that was a game that I always, always remembered from then on. And I think we did as teammates, is like, we massively underestimated them. We were incredibly arrogant, and let's not ever, ever do that again. But there's lots of those bits.
So that's an interesting point. So you talk about the building up, which is great. And we've done well. So what with that particular match went kind of in the wrong direction? Without sort of playing, you know, it's a particular match, but the difference between confidence and arrogance, where does that line? Because a lot of organizations, a lot of business leaders do become very arrogant, and there's a lot of hubris. So how do you make sure that you're still grounded?
I think that was, there was all sorts, without going on history, there'd been a British Lions tour the year before. I hadn't gone on it because I'd fractured my leg. So there was a lot of discussions going on about what had happened and who had played well and who hadn't on that tour. So we came up against this game, and our training was very good. But what we didn't do is just take the step back and say, okay, what are they going to try and do to put us off our rhythm? We had played very well, and we were favourites. And so you go, right, guys, let's be honest, we were overconfident. We did not, for a second, just sit and go, right, let's have a think. How are they going to try and ruin our rhythm? How are they going to disrupt us? How are they, you know? And that was the arrogance, was not, and it's that fine balance. But earlier in the week, we should have sat there and gone, listen, okay, they've got some really good players. These are their strengths. This is probably where they're going to try and focus their game. And we didn't do any of that. It was almost like, geez, we're playing well. We're training well. We're in good shape. We're going to go out and we're going to win. And, you know, we could have taken, you know, a number of meetings just to analyze it, just to ground ourselves, just to sort of say, listen, let's be aware, let's be prepared. And we weren't prepared for what they were about to do. And therefore, we could have then built up our confidence, you know, at the end of the week, but we just did not prepare ourselves. And that's overconfidence.
So that's a good example. I've got a question here in the from one of the delegates. Is that how do you deal with that setback? So you cruised into that match thinking you were going to do well. Yep. Big shock, big surprise. It's not like going against Jonah Lomu, which I should imagine you kind of didn't underestimate by any imagination. But this one you did. What do you look back? Were you a better team afterwards? What did you learn from that loss, and how did you make yourselves better as a result of it, or any of the losses?
I think it's funny, and I have to be careful. I was talking with some of the current guys, just trying, because you know you're learning about what is it that motivates them. And for me, I think it was almost like the fear of losing was my drive rather than the thrill of winning. So Scotland, losing that was just right. It was weeks and weeks of sitting there and going, what did you get wrong as captain? What did we get wrong as a team? And being really honest about. And I got wrong, the preparation. I got wrong in the game. I didn't know the right, you know, the guys to talk to under pressure. I talked to the wrong guys at the wrong time. You know, guys who red mist had descended. So I didn't know my players well enough. And, you know, that's a mistake of a leader. And I hadn't prepared them. I hadn't got them in the right frame of mind mentally in the week. And so there was lots and lots of bits that I had got wrong. And there's lots of bits that we got wrong as a team. But, you know, our team still talked about that game 7 years later. The people who were still there every time you played, it was still that game 7 years later.
Was that a motivator to be better?
Oh, yeah. But to learn that whole thing about, right, how do we alter our preparation the week? What do we need to include to make sure we don't make that mistake against anyone? Not just, you know, Scotland, but anyone. So we need to build in analysis. We need to build in this. We need to have honest conversations. When do we check where we are, you know, in terms of emotion? And I think I think things that sports people are aware of is there's an emotional state. When do you play your best game? Someone said to me, Will, what emotional state were you in when you used to play your best game? I knew exactly what it was. And it's like, and can you get there every game? And yeah, I could, because I don't know when, but I used to spend an hour a day just thinking through bits and pieces. And so the way you think is the way you feel, and the way you feel is the way you perform. So for me, you know, thinking, you train yourself to think, you visualize bits and pieces. That makes you feel a certain way, and then you perform. Because otherwise, you hear lots of people going, God, you know what, I feel great today. I'm going to be good. And you go, you can feel great every time you play, if you get your thinking right. And I wonder in business a lot of the time, if we know what's my best emotional state for a presentation, for a board meeting, for whatever it is. Do I know what it is? And more importantly, do I know how to get there every time? Do I know, you know, what it takes, how I need to think, my process? Do I train hard enough to, you know, to think, you know, in the right way? And a lot of the time, I don't think we do. So, you know, when it comes to defeat, you've just got to understand about, right, I need to rethink that, you know, make sure that I wasn't in the right emotional state, and we weren't as a team in the right emotional state.
It's interesting. So take back to the 90s. You know, you're talking a lot about emotions, feelings, et cetera, et cetera. That's quite radical for the 90s in an all-male environment. It certainly felt like at that point. It was, you know, so were you, attuned in a way that you think was ahead of the game at that point, not just the rugby game, but just general society as a whole. People, you know, one of the questions I saw recently was does being British and having stiff upper lip actually hold us back in so many ways? And I think we've got better than that. But did you feel that emotion and mental health and well-being at that point, was that easy to talk about?
Well, I just think, I mean, the classic thing was for me, you know, 22 captain, you got made into this caricature, I said, you know, and the caricature was, you know, British, stiff upper lip, arrogant, you know, and you're thinking, I was a lot of things, but I wasn't those. And my view was in terms of you get the honour of leading some people. You know, I wanted to get to know these people as men, not rugby players. Because I think if you're going to lead people, you have to understand and you have to know them as people and you have to care about them. And I think, you know, for me, that's just because if someone's going to lead me, I want to be cared about. You know, I want someone to take an interest in me. They wanted to try and understand me and how I think. And I, you know, I'm probably way more sensitive than lots of people, whatever I am, you know, but and far more emotional. But I think that's just, you know, there's the male rubbish, you know, bullshit, you know, about all that. You know, thinking anyone can shout loudly and bark and pretend, you know, man up and all that sort of stuff. And it's like, yeah, you know, that's great. But actually, leadership is about, you know, a lot of the time, I think it's about being emotionally aware about people, about caring, about getting them in the right frame of mind. So that for me was a huge part of what I just, it's common sense. You know, I just think it's, we're not, whatever men like to pretend, you know, about being hard and all that, you know, it's rather like a conversation. I think I was saying to you, my 17-year-old, when she show jumps and she was scared after she'd done some stuff. And I was sitting talking to her and I said, Meems, do you think brave people aren't scared? And she sort of, well, I don't know. I said, I know a few. They get scared, but they're still brave. I said, I just believe brave people are scared. They manage to, you know, to push through, and they manage to encourage others in their team and give them the confidence to push through and still to achieve. And, you know, I was scared every game I played. I was, you know, in the build-up, you're scared about making the big mistake that loses the game. You're scared about freezing. You're scared about letting, more than anything, you're scared about letting your teammates down. And you were scared, you know, but you know, you had processes mentally to get through that. But, you know, and I just don't believe in that whole macho rubbish, because I, you know, I've been lucky enough to meet some very brave men, and, you know, and I've seen them in an honest environment. And there's lots of emotion and there's lots of fear and there's lots of trepidation. And that's humans, you know, and that's us and that's real.
So what you're saying is absolutely wonderful. And it is shows how far we've come. Now, it's interesting that we're flashing back to then, but obviously you work with the team now, but you also work with teams outside sport. You yeah. work with businesses and other organizations and stuff. What are the observations that you see in terms, what is good practice about well-being and mental health within organizations that you're seeing in terms of leaders? Well, who would, not necessarily who in terms of names of people, but what do you see that goes, God, that's good. They really are getting their team, their groups working well together because they're actually looking beyond just bottom line profit, sales, whatever. They're actually talking about the well-being and the mental health of the team. Are you seeing good stuff?
Yeah, I have. And I think it's just understanding that we are humans. We have frailties. We have flaws. And it's just understanding that, you know, to really get teams to perform and people to perform, I think communication almost above all else in terms of behaviours as well is, it's being able to have people to be honest, be able to talk about at work things that concern them, things that they're not clear about, and actually to be able to share that information without that being seen as, you know, oh, you're a drain on me, you know, or, you know, I thought, you know, that I explained that to you last week and it's like, okay, but I'm still not, you know, but it's almost like, and for leaders to understand that they don't have to know all the questions. You don't have to be there leading the way. You know, I think leadership is, you know, just because you're asking other people to take on a role at some point. My view with England, I suppose, and our team was, I wanted us to, and I think great teams like this have three abilities. One is to be the best player you can be, but one is to be a coach, and one is to be, you know, a leader. And the coaching bit, and I think the good teams that I see in business are the ones that start, you know, we start coaching each other. And I remember standing, this is probably way too old for your audience, but I remember standing watching, I played alongside a guy called Jerry Gusker, who was absolutely brilliant. And I was standing watching him do something at training, and Austin, our psychologist, was standing next to him, and he said, "Will, how often do you ask Jerry to coach you?" And I looked at him, I went, "Coach me." And he went, "Yeah." I went, "No, I never have, Austin." And he said, "Why?" I said, "Too proud." And he said, "Think about it." And I said, "Oh, yeah, I will." And I think it would just hit me. And I thought, Christ, actually, this is the bit that we should be coaching each other. You know, there are guys in here who are the best at that. And I think you go into businesses and you must sit in the team and think, wow, she's the best at that. Why don't I go over and ask her how to do that? And so the key is to have the humility to ask and then the ability to coach. And I think, you know, that's when you start seeing teams look after each other and help each other and coach each other, and they have the conversations. And that's mental well-being, because it's almost like we can be who we are, you know, and we're up at some times, we're down at some, but, you know, that's real, that, you know, and that's life. That's us. And I think that's teams.
So we're going through a very tough period as a country now, you and I were talking about it before we came on. And it's hard for a lot of people. A lot of the camaraderie of organizations, we're all working remotely, we're all sort of separate. Relationships have become very transactional. So there's a group dynamic thing that is getting much harder. But also, people have a lot of concerns in their lives. Their concerns about their jobs, their concerns about their personal resilience, their personal health. Could you just kind of give us a few ideas? You've been through some tough times. I mean, you were interviewed in The Guardian earlier this year in a really good, very honest article about challenges that you've been through. How have you got through? Where does your resilience come from? What have you learned through the darker periods of your life that can give some insight into what might help others?
I just think, you know, when you get down, sometimes for me, in my life, you know, there was a sporting bit, but after that, when you've made an incredible mess of your life, that you sit there and you go right down to the bottom, and what I've done, and I still do, is you look and think, you know, sometimes, you know, I sit outside and you think, hey, I know sadly some friends, you know, who've died way too young, and I think, I'm listening to birds. I'm looking, there's a blue sky, you know, I'm drinking coffee. It's like you just start being grateful for tiny little bits, and you can slowly build that up to think, actually, okay, fine. So, you know, things are not that bad. And for me, you know, in sport, when it came to wanting to perform, you might be going through a dip. I'd sit there, I'd lie there, and I'd run through things that I'd done well, you know, moments that I'd really enjoyed. You'd run through them in your head. And you go, well, you know, you can do this. You've done it. You can do it again. And you'd run these things and run these things and different. And eventually you'd start thinking, oh, yeah, do you know what? Yeah, I can, you know. And it's, but I do, in life, it's just, you know, you look and think, there are lots of bits that we can all, even now, you know, I agree, it's a tough time now. And sometimes, you know, if you sit still and you sit down, you go, but actually just start thinking about a few good bits that are still there. And it's just like, okay, yeah, we've still got those. And actually, yeah, we've still got that. And then there's that. And you do, you just, for me, I just think, okay, actually, it's not that bad. And it just gives you a little bit more energy to think, okay, you know, we can get on and, you know, what's the first thing I'm going to tackle? And, you know, right, I've got a bit more of a positive view on it, and I'll get on with it. And I think, I don't know, it's very basic, but it's just running through in your head, I think, that there's, you know, you've done it before, you've been successful, most of us, if we've got there, and it's run through those bits, just give yourself that confidence and belief that actually, I'll be okay, you know, we'll do this again.
And I think it's also just looking at you and saying, I think you were a incredibly successful sports star and leader earlier on in your life. But actually, it's, you know, 30 years later, you've managed to also transition your career into a different sphere and being successful as well. So any tips about people? Because the idea that you're one job for all of your life, I mean, a lot of sports people don't make a transition into kind of civvy street or whatever. They kind of make their name young at something, and then everything is a sad reflection on that. How, you know, lots of us are now looking at second, third, fourth careers, transitions to that. And any observations that you'd like to share on moving, changing?
Well, I think it's what I was saying before about being curious, about being interested in people, wanting to learn all the time, you know, wanting to improve. I also think I don't believe in living looking back, you know. And it was rather, you know, my youngest was asked me, oh, this was not long ago, something came up, and I sort of said, oh yeah, no, I love playing. And she said, did you love playing rugby? And I said, yeah, why? She goes, well, I didn't think you did. And I said, why? She goes, you never talk about it. And I sort of looked at her and I said, I know. And she goes, why? I said, because I love now more than I love that. I said, I love being with you more. I love my family more. I love now. And, you know, that to a certain extent is it. I think sometimes are very sad when I watch people who are just looking back the whole time saying that, God, back then it was great. And you go, no, now is great, you know, because you've got now, and lots of people won't have now. So therefore, it's to think, what's next? What can I experience? What can I learn? What can I, you know, you just think, geez, we're lucky to be around. And that's my view. And therefore, there's lots of challenges. And if we sit and listen and learn and are curious about things, I think, you know, there are opportunities out there for people. It's just you've got to keep your eyes open and you've got to keep looking for them.
I think that is amazing. I've got one more minute, but I actually want to end on that, because at this point, there's just so much sad news. There is so much depressing news that actually accentuating the positive is really quite important. It doesn't mean being in complete deluded la-la land.
No.
It's actually trying to find those rays of sunshine.
We will get through it, Mark. We will. And lots of us will be lucky, and we will. And therefore, it's, you know, my view is, and let's look back and think, what would you learn from that? Because, you know, let's make sure we enjoy X, Y, and Z that much more when we're given our freedom back.
Brilliant. Will, it's an absolute delight. The time has gone in a split second, it felt like. Really enjoyed chatting with you. Appreciate hugely being part of this, for your contribution to Mad World and to the subject of well-being and mental health. So, Will, lovely session with you.